Light Shining in the Forest by Paul Tordé. Read by David Timpson. Catherine Mayer, founder of the children's charity Parents and Abducted Children Together, said, "The truth is, we don't know how many children go missing, which is an appalling state of affairs. But the best estimate we have shows that every 5 minutes a child goes missing in the UK. It is really quite shocking," she added. Mike Sullivan, crime editor, The Sun, 11th of October 2007. Chapter 1. Kielder Forest lies along the English and Scottish borders. A few hundred years ago, all this part of the world was a desolation of mires and low, heather-covered hills. Its inhabitants, more then than there are now, were once considered masterless men who acknowledged no king and lived by violence and cunning. The border clans were known as Reavers, and they lived on either side of the border, in Liddesdale, Teviotdale, Reedsdale and Tynedale. Clans such as the Armstrongs, Bells, Charltons, Dodds, Elliots, Kerrs, Nixons and Scots. They stole from each other and fought with each other. The border region was difficult for any king to control, whether he was king of Scotland or England. For a while it was known as the Debatable Land. It is an empty and silent country. Even today, on this crowded island, there are spaces along the borders where you can walk for a day without ever seeing another human being. The country itself has changed. Once there were grey-green hills covered in rushes and heather. Steep-sided deans scored the hillsides, thick with birch, alder, willow, oak and pine. These ancient woods have now been replaced by a patchwork of huge forests. Wark, Kielder, Reedsdale, Harwood, Newcastleton, Crake, Tinnisburn, Spade Adam and Kershope, spread across hundreds of square miles. Tens of millions of trees, Sitka spruce, Norway spruce, lodgepole pine, larch, Scots pine, a dark host only occasionally relieved by avenues of broadleaves. Who lives there now? A few forestry communities, scattered villages and isolated hamlets. Foxes, deer, buzzards, goshawks, jays, magpies, ravens and crows far outnumber the human inhabitants. Once there were red and black grouse living in the heather-clad hills and grey partridge in the white grassland. But the predators that live among the trees, the hawks and the foxes, have dealt with most of these. Nothing much else lives here. Nothing except the trees themselves. Intersecting the forest is a labyrinth of graded roads. Each year, several million trees are planted, and as many more are extracted, taken by road down to the chipboard factory in Hexham, or to the Tyne docks, or to the stockyards of timber businesses and fencing contractors. Most of what is logged is softwood, not suited for joinery or cabinet making, and destined for some industrial purpose. The roads are cut through the forest as they are needed, and then abandoned, chained off to prevent access, quickly overtaken by weeds, and then by regenerating pine and fir. Kielder Forest alone covers 250 square miles, and its siblings cover maybe twice that area. Before the trees came, this was a land of marshes and rolling grass hills. Across the hills ran the old droving roads, along which sheep were driven to markets further south, or else to the strongholds of the local clans. The place names recall the former nature of the land and its people. Haggering Holes, Bess's Bog, Bloody Bush, Foulmire Heights, Greymare Moss. The mires and moss were a perfect protection for the Reavers who once inhabited this region. It was a landscape of a thousand soft colours. The subtle shades of heathers, bog myrtle, sphagnum moss, cotton grass, lichens and the whites and browns of the grasslands. An infinitely varied palette, changing with every shift of light from the cloudy, windy skies above. Now only corners of this older world can be glimpsed, in places where it has not yet been submerged in the sea of conifers. Many of the trees were planted in the 1920s as part of a national undertaking to replace timber consumed in the trenches in France during the First World War. Much later, an enormous lake appeared in the forest. It was created by damming the headwaters of the North Tyne, 17 miles of it between tree-clad banks, to provide water for industry further east. A drowned village lies beneath its waves. As for the trees, it is difficult to know what purpose they now have. They have become an end in themselves, a reason for their own existence. The trees are there because the trees are there. Geordie Nixon has worked in forestry for most of his life. His father and his grandfather were woodmen. His father tended the private forestry of a local estate. In those days, trees were still worth money. Ash, beech and oak for furniture. Larch was once cropped for ships' masts. Now, a tide of cheap timber from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union has made homegrown woodlands close to worthless. His father was made redundant and died young, age 60. His mother died a few years later, still working as a cleaner. Geordie began by helping his father during the school holidays. When he was 16, he left school and started work as a fencing contractor. He's done fencing, planting, weeding amongst the young trees. Now he's registered as a lone worker and he harvests the trees in Kielder for the Forestry Commission. He has known nothing else. He visits Hexham, the nearest town of any size. He's been to Newcastle, the nearest city, twice. He's never been to London and has no plans to go there. He barely knows where London is. What he does know is the forest and the birds and the animals that live there. Almost every day he sees the deer lifting their heads to look at him as he drives deep into the forest in his truck. In their season, he hears the vixens shouting. He knows where the badger sets are. From time to time, he hears the scream of a rabbit being taken by a hawk. These sounds and shapes and sights are his company when he works in the forest. He works in all weathers, in the faint sunshine that sometimes filters down through the trees, in driving rain, sometimes in the soft and soundless fall of snow, when the forest seems to go to sleep under its white blanket. You don't find men like Geordie Nixon in towns. You find few men like Geordie anywhere. He's a big man, over 6 feet tall, and he looks as tough as the trees he cuts down. He has a square, pale face and grey eyes under thick black eyebrows. His life is work. The money comes in, and it goes out even faster. Geordie knows he won't die a rich man. He doesn't think much about the future. He knows he has to meet the lease payments on his vehicles and his HP on the 40-inch HD television in the flat. He has to pay his girlfriend, Mary, his share of the rent on her flat and his share of the food and heating. He owns nothing except the clothes he stands in, his chainsaw and his mobile phone. At first light, Geordie Nixon is working with the chainsaw and is already well into the area of forest marked out for clear felling. He cuts away the small trees and other bits of rubbish to allow the harvester to reach the bigger trees that have to be felled and logged. By 8:30, he is cutting down trees in his harharvester, a second-hand Valmet 941. It is tracked to cope with the soft ground. Rubber tires would just dig in and sink. The whole of this forest grew out of bottomless mires, or else fell land full of sharp rocks. Geordie is contracted to cut down a block of 30-year-old Sitka spruce. The harvester grinds and chugs and whines as its hydraulically powered jaws grab a tree and then bite into its base. In a few seconds, the tree has been cut, but it is not allowed to fall. Instead, the harvester tilts the tree over in its jaws and strips off the branches and most of the bark, then cuts it to length before placing it on top of a growing pile of poles beside the forest track. Geordie works alone. It's what he prefers. There isn't the money in the job to pay the wages of another man. Once he would have had a lad helping with the stacking of the felled timber so that he didn't have to load up his truck at the end of the day. Now he has to do it himself. But even Geordie knows about market forces. He's seen the price of timber go down year after year. Every now and then he stops to take a nip of lukewarm tea from his thermos, or else to light a cigarette. When he switches off the engine of the harvester, the silence of the forest is uncomfortable. At midday, he stops again and eats the packed lunch, his bait, he calls it, that Mary has put up for him the night before. Processed cheese slices in a bap, with not enough butter. He eats the dry food mechanically and swallows the last of his tea. Although it is only early April, there is a hatch of midges. These trouble him whenever he opens the door of the cab. Around him, a soft light filters through the forest canopy, a hint of the sun far above the clouds, just enough to gleam on the wet cobwebs on every branch, on the wet bracken by the edge of the wood, on the pools of water lying everywhere. From his cab, Geordie can see down into the shallow valley on whose upper slopes he is working. Nothing but spruce and pine, nothing but trees in their endless dark tangles. The light turns greyer in the afternoon as the cloud thickens. Dusk comes early to these places. Beneath the shadow of the trees, it never really leaves. At 4 o'clock, he locks up the harvester and walks down to the forest track where he's parked his truck. This is a big Scania tractor-trailer, with a jib crane at the back for loading up the timber. That and the harvester are leased to him by a finance company. He has a girlfriend, Mary, whom he thinks of as his lass. Once they had a child as well. He begins loading the stacked timber from the roadside onto his truck. This is a hard task that requires patience. Stack it badly, and it might start rolling, and then the whole trailer could tip over. After an hour or more, he's finished the job. And he's finished too. He's absolutely shattered. It's not just the one day's labour, it's the unending labour of 100 days, 1,000 days. He's grateful for the work, but it's killing him. Then he remembers the pills Stevie sold him in the pub a couple of nights ago. He doesn't know exactly what they are. "Man, you can gum forever on these," was how Stevie made his pitch. Amphetamines, benzodrine, mephedrone, who cares, as long as they sort him out. They do something to him, that's for sure. Half an hour after taking them, he feels less tired, but also a whole lot worse, as if something has changed inside him, or something outside has changed. But he's not sure what. Maybe it's the pills. Maybe not. As dusk approaches, his sense of unease grows. All his life, Geordie has worked alone. He's used to being in the middle of nowhere. This is the middle of nowhere, a remote area of the forest between Kershope Rig and Black Line Common. Walkers and farmers rarely come here. There is no reason to. No grazing, no paths that go anywhere. Nothing to see except trees. There's nobody here, not at this time of day. He has heard the barking of foxes, the alarm calls of birds, and often he has heard the screams of buzzards overhead as they float sideways in the winds that never stop blowing across these border hills. Now, all he hears is the silence, and it is getting on his nerves. When the trailer has been loaded and the huge stack of wooden poles secured, he climbs into the cab of the big Scania and turns the key in the ignition. He knows that the pills have done something weird to him. He wishes he hadn't taken them, but it's too late for that. His heart is pounding much too fast, and he can feel the sweat beading on his forehead. He flicks on the headlights as he enters the dark tunnel of trees, following the intricate and confusing maze of forest roads down into the valley of the North Tyne to Leaplish, and on down to the chipboard factory in Hexham to drop off his load. When he's done that, he will drive to the village beside the Tyne where Mary and he live in their flat. There's something else getting into his head, something he thinks he has seen rather than heard. He switches on some music to drown out these odd and unwelcome thoughts. Not really thoughts, but flashes from somewhere, arriving in his brain like radio signals. Then the huge truck meets Blacktop Road, and he pushes the accelerator to the floor. Headlamps on full beam, the trailer sways dangerously as he drives much too fast down the valley. Only when the lights of the first villages appear does he slow down a little. As he drives through them, images come to him. Images of children. In many of the houses, lights glow from upstairs windows. He imagines that those lights are illuminating bathrooms and bedrooms. He imagines children at their bath time, children having stories read to them by their parents, sitting on the side of the bed, turning the pages in the gentle glow of a bedside lamp. He imagines the children turning over sleepily in bed and murmuring good night. He imagines, so clearly, the father and the mother smiling at each other as they close the door softly on the sleeping child. He imagines it. He remembers it. Mary is watching television when he arrives home. She stands up as he comes through the door, but does not offer him a kiss or greet him in any way. Instead, she puts the kettle on. She knows he won't eat straight away. He is too tired to eat, almost too tired to speak. He accepts a mug of tea from her and asks how she is.
All right.
A little later, he stands up as if uncertain what to do next. Mary asks,
Will I get you something to eat?
No. I'll do myself a fry-up in the morning.
She leaves the room. He hears her running the tap in the bathroom and then the door of her room shuts. It isn't really her bedroom. It used to be the nursery where the boy slept. He disappeared just before Christmas, when most buildings in the street had fairy lights hanging over the door and Christmas trees visible through the windows. He disappeared while they were starting to wrap his Christmas presents, while Christmas carols played incessantly on the radio and Christmas jingles played over the public address systems in the supermarkets. That was 4 months ago, and more. Mary hasn't changed anything. The toys are all still in the cupboards. The ceiling is still pasted with stars and crescent moons that glow a little in the dark when the lights are switched off. Mary moved in there a few weeks after the boy went. She and Geordie haven't shared a bed since. They haven't shared much else either. Not their thoughts, not their worries. They have plenty of those, but they no longer talk about them. It's one of those things. She doesn't particularly blame Geordie for what happened. That's to say, she blames him equally along with the rest of the human race. An hour or two later, Geordie switches off the television. He has no idea what he has been watching. He goes to the bathroom and brushes his teeth. He goes to their bedroom and strips off to his boxer shorts and climbs into bed. He sleeps in the middle now. It's less lonely. After a few minutes, he falls asleep. But it is not the dreamless sleep of the tired man. His hands twitch and he moans once or twice. Then he mutters to himself,
Light in the forest, light in the forest.
There is no one to hear him, and when he wakes in the morning, he doesn't remember his dreams. There is no one beside him to ask how he slept or nuzzle against him for a moment before he steps out of bed. He showers, then dresses laboriously, for the tiredness from the day before hasn't left him. He goes into the kitchen and puts on the kettle. He raps gently on Mary's door to see if she wants a cup of tea bringing in. There is no answer. They still love each other, he tells himself, although it's hard to say why or how you would know. They see so little of one another these days. He cooks himself a good breakfast, 2 fried eggs, beans, tinned tomatoes, bacon, a mug of hot tea with 2 sugars. After he has eaten, he experiences a rush as the glucose and the fats surge into his bloodstream, an illusion of energy, an illusion of purpose. By the time he has climbed into the truck and started it up, that flicker has died down again, and he already feels weary as he heads north back towards the forest.